Hi, you've reached Solidarity House, but we can't take your call. If you have a message for Yana, Scully, Jabron, Matt, or anybody else, please leave it now.
Hi, it's Marty. Sorry if I'm going too late. It's 2 a.m. here, and as usual, I'm pretty wired. I just wanted to say congratulations on acquiring land for your commune. That's a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment. I know you're going to do a great job restoring that beautiful house and a great job with the podcast. And let me just make one thing clear. You will never be too big to fail. Goodbye, good luck, and also, I want a fucking one.
Hi, I'm Matt.
The first time
and
today.
And I am playing the guitar as if I am playing the very first time.
So, on to the meeting agenda. So the first thing is just like getting updates from each other so we all know what's happening with stuff. And these were the four pieces that I think we didn't like complete or get to a place where now it's in somebody else's hands. So that's propane, selling stuff, carpenter, and the internet socks. So, let's just take them in order.
And that is if we decide to go with electricity instead of propane.
There are good reasons for that, including saving some money in the short run, as well as convertibility to solar later.
Wikipedia definition in front of me. An intentional community is a planned residential community designed from the start to have a high degree of social cohesion and teamwork. The members of an intentional community typically hold a common social, political, religious, or spiritual vision and often follow an alternative lifestyle.
No, that's actually a good definition overall, I think. It captures kind of the really broad range of what constitutes an intentional community, proximity, and having some sort of ideological or value coherence.
And then a commune is like into tighter cohesion, typically through resource and income sharing.
Generally speaking, has an explicit value of egalitarianism and uses income sharing and labor sharing as ways of trying to actualize that. One of the really important problems that a lot of these communities have, right, is when you try to break down this the concept of power, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about like having political power versus having social power. And in a community, that difference becomes really blurry because if decisions are made by the whole group and based on what everyone believes, if you have a great deal of social power, it's very easy for you to convince other people to do what you want. It's very easy to potentially coerce them. And so political power and social power kind of become collapsed when we start to talk about these really small groups.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the ways that which communes and really all kinds of communities can run into problems. More than growing up in communities, one of the things that has given me some insight into the movement more broadly is that my mother, Yana, also on the podcast, was and still is a facilitator, is a professional facilitator and teaches like conflict resolution and like how to run good meetings. And so I ended up traveling with her a great deal as a child and getting to see a huge variety of communities. So
mm-hmm.
I've lived in like half a dozen communities, but I visited maybe like 50 to 100. The real profound moment of culture shock, though, was when I went to college, because before that point, I had been able to interact with that culture largely at a distance, or I had been interacting mostly with people who were in my parents' social circles, who tended to be more, if not, you know, left-leaning, at least liberal.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a very warped idea of the world, but not... I don't think much more so than like the average person, really,
mm-hmm.
right? Like I think most people when they're like 17 don't really understand the world very well. When I was 17, I was under the impression that, going back to feminism, the default cultural attitude was feminism is like just a baseline cultural value, because I had grown up in places where a really great effort was made to actually practice it practically. And
mm-hmm.
of course, you know, flawed, but still a huge effort was made. And so on a very baseline, I really assumed that that was just a value everyone held. And then when I got out into the, you know, broader culture, going to school in Chicago, it became clear pretty quickly that that was not the case.
I think WH
W.H. Holiday.
So they built this house in 1878. And I'm kind of assuming that's when they finished it, but it may have taken a while because it was a big project.
They were builders.
Yeah.
They were builders. They built all
kinds
of things.
Was it constructing
Chicago
barons? Is that what they were?
They were real estate and construction magnates of Laramie. And I don't know if just Laramie, but my mouth is all dry now and there's no liquid here.
Sorry, I drank all the chocolate, soy milk is gone.
Damn it.
Yeah, so
we have
he built it originally.
A phrenology report on him.
We do. We have a phrenology report, and so
what
we could delve into that.
What does the phrenology report conclude? Do we have
any
idea?
I haven't looked through all of it because it was very, very sprawling cursive. It was written
does it, like does it say that W.H. Holiday ought to be a genetic leader, a leader in the, because this is like the turn
probably
of the century or
right.
So.
I mean, was he white? Well, so we know he was what we think of as a sort of a progressive of his day. Like apparently he kind of single-handedly ran the Nazis of the day out of Laramie. That he hung out with Teddy Roosevelt, and Teddy Roosevelt hung out in this house apparently with some regularity.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to delve into more about the man himself.
Conversations about progressive imperialism that took place in the Holiday House when Teddy Roosevelt was a guest here. There was probably at least some talk of the way in which the United States could benevolently.
You don't think he was just out here shooting shit?
World. He was absolutely out here to hunt, and there's an article where he rode from Cheyenne. Maybe he rode from Cheyenne to Laramie.
He was Cheyenne
like,
to Laramie.
I took my
horse.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Or somebody, you know, said about him that he rode his horse from Cheyenne to Laramie. This is Teddy Roosevelt, and when he got here, he undoubtedly stayed in this house. So,
in the room that we call Kara's room.
It's a strange
art room.
It's a strange connection to someone that we would otherwise never have any connection to whatsoever. The mansion was originally built on 4th and Garfield. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Which
is where it sat until the 80s sometime.
There is at least one archive article or one sort of historic places article that refers to a Holiday House on 7th and Grant. And I'm wondering, although 4th and Garfield is very close to 7th and Grant, and so I don't know what that could mean, or if it's some other house that the Holiday contractor built, because they built a lot of different things. And if you read through some of the other historic buildings in town, some which are no longer standing, they did that.
And it was in the family until sometime in the 30s. I'm fuzzy on what was happening for a while there. I heard from someone early on when we were still in the process of buying this place that it was actually a brothel for a little while. And so that might be why we're fuzzy on it, because maybe that didn't get recorded in the same way that some of this other stuff got recorded. And then it was the offices of the Boomerang, which is the local paper here, for a while. And apparently the fireplace that is in the what we call the meeting room or the workshop room like came out of the Boomerang period. So it was not original, that particular fireplace. And then it was condemned. And some dude whose name I have yet to come across asked if he could have it, if he would move it. And so I think he bought
so
it for a dollar.
We don't actually even know the name.
I don't. And a couple of people have like said it to me, and it's gone in one ear, out the other, because I've been like, you know,
so much
at work or something when somebody said it. And so he moved it out here, and I had been told that it was moved all in one piece, but then Matt, you were told it was moved in multiple pieces, right?
I feel like the dominant narrative is that it came out here in one piece.
Yeah,
and
most
I feel
of the
like
people that I've talked to.
Yeah.
Have talked about like the there was one person who came out for the garage sale that we had a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about her memories of it. She thought so it's apparently happened sometime in the 80s, but some people think it's like it was the late 70s, early 80s. So it was like 78, 79, 80 something. Mm. Because they talk about, and the woman that was here talked about it taking them 3 days to build the platform, mm-hmm. and 3 days to like put the house onto the platform. The moving process of that alone took 3 days. And then the moving process, like the once it got on the road, it was going like a 16th of a mile an hour. And they had to cut down the power lines on the sides of all mm-hmm. along the road.
Mm-hmm. So it was
a huge affair, and people mm-hmm. were coming out to see it and watching them and walking alongside the house, and it was
sounds like it was kind of like a slow-mo parade, mm-hmm. you know, that like everything sort of came to a halt.
Hey, Rhiannon.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, this is my housemate, Scully.
Hello.
Hey, Scully.
Hi, it's nice to hear from you, Rhiannon. I'm excited to hear about your story.
So, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. I've spent most of my life in Missouri, went to grad school in Iowa, and the Confederate flag is not uncommon. I saw, you know, people would wear it on their belt. To middle school, it would be, you know, in a window when you drive past a house or up flagpoles, sold on merchandise at every gas station in the state. So it's a relatively common symbol where I'm at, but it's become increasingly common in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. and I'm just seeing more Confederate flags than I ever have, and it wasn't uncommon before. Something that's always made me uncomfortable, like a lot of people, to see open expressions of hate. So when I saw a truck at my family's doctor's office, we have a pretty big family, so we're at the doctor's office a lot. And I saw the truck and I assumed that it was a man's truck. I have these really internalized rigid gender roles. So when I saw a GMC truck with a Confederate flag license plate, I wrongly assumed it was a man. And I'll tell you, even after later I realized a woman owned the truck, I would still find myself flipping that script and saying he. Just, you know, one of the things I keep in mind all the time is my own tendency to make errors, to operate with this internalized system that I have in place. And this is an example of it. So it was a woman's truck. The first time I saw it, I wrote a snarky little note. I've been writing letters a lot this last couple of years. And so I had some nice stationery in my purse. And I wrote a little note, something like, oops, your white supremacy is showing. And I left it on her truck. And I came back a month later, and you know, the truck is still there. So I left another note. The third time I knew to expect that the truck was going to be there at the doctor's office in the same spot where it always is. And I may have even, you know, seen it a couple times and not left a note at all. So the third time I created a sign quoting some Confederate folks that I read in a Ta-Nehisi Coates article, actually, for The Atlantic. And I left it outside of the truck. I sort of staked it in the ground pretty big. And so it went from like this private confrontation to a public confrontation. The next time I came back, she had doubled down and bought a new flag. So it wasn't just the Confederate flag on the license plate. Now it was a flag. She actually had two flags on either side of her windows. One is a Confederate flag and one's an American flag. So she's really conflicted. She doesn't know what's going on. So I realized that the method I was using was not having the desired effect. She was just feeling more empowered, reaffirming her commitment to white supremacy. Yeah. So I had to take a different path. You know, my purpose was never to change her mind. There are people who do that work, and I think that work is really valuable. And maybe if I had known her outside of, you know, the context of my doctor's office, that would have been a goal I had. But that was not the goal of this. It was confrontation, disruption, agitation. So once I see that I have created this space for her to more comfortably express it, you know, she's feeling, I don't know, just really empowered by it. So I decided to try to change policy. So I did some research. I found evidence, you know, the prior EEOC rulings on Confederate flags in the workplace. I found evidence about the health effects of racism and microaggressions in the workplace, and then for patients of color as well. One of the most interesting studies I found was the effect that Confederate flags or hate symbols can have on white audiences. There's a study that was done when Obama was running for office, and they showed Confederate flags to voters, and they demonstrated that people were less likely after being exposed to the Confederate flag to support a candidate of color. In other words, everybody is impacted when we see the Confederate flag. So I wrote a letter and shared it on social media. I actually shared it as an open Google Doc for people to contribute to. I did have a couple of folks who helped me make some edits, and so that was awesome. And then I sent it to my doctor's office, actually on a Facebook page, and they called me within 20 minutes. And over the next few weeks, they worked to identify who the employee was, and then they ultimately made her remove the Confederate flags. At this point, there are 3 Confederate flags on her truck, and she had to remove all of them.
Like, did you just Google these studies? Have you been familiar with them before? Like the one that talked about impact of hate symbols on white people and people of color. Like, did you just start Googling?
Yeah, so some of the research I was familiar with, as was one of the themes in my classes, I have students research social justice issues that impact their communities. And I have a number of students in the past have written on healthcare disparities or the psychophysical effects of racism, for example. So I was pretty familiar with the ways that racism can impact people of color.
You knew where to look.
Yeah, I knew where to look, but I will say that the research on the effects on white people was new to me, and it was something, I don't remember if I found it through Google or through the databases at work, but really helpful article and deepened my understanding of the impact.
This, for me, connects pretty deeply to the only other interview that I have been a part of so far on the podcast, who proudly waves the what she calls the rebel flag. So my next question is basically, can you send me all of this research that you have done? Because part of my goal here is to try and bridge the gap of understanding there, because when she talks about the rebel flag or the Confederate flag, she often talks about it in a, like, she wants to preserve the history of what it was and to be honest about the history. And she fears that if we, like, she's one of the people who doesn't, like, is strongly opposed to taking down Confederate statues. And her reasoning, the reasoning that she told us was because she fears that history will repeat itself if we don't have indications of history.
Scully, your situation is more nuanced than mine and more personal. So it's, I think, more difficult to navigate. I've certainly had interpersonal relationships with people who expressed any number of, you know, I'm white and a lot of the people I interact with are white. And so, you know, white people are racist. We have, in the same way that I've internalized those gender norms I talked about earlier, I've also internalized racism. So I have had a lot of difficult conversations with people who don't identify the racism that they've internalized. And I do think that those conversations are more difficult to navigate. It was, you know, the work that I took no risk. It was not like I put myself out on the line. It barely even took time. It's got to be about somebody's willingness to self-educate and to really interrogate their own understanding of history. I mean, I think if the goal is to prevent history from repeating itself, I don't know that we do that by displaying symbols of hate or our history. I don't, if that worked, we wouldn't be where we are now. In Kansas City here, we have J.C. Nichols Street, J.C. Nichols Memorial Fountain, and Jesse Clyde Nichols is one of the, he really pioneered residential segregation through property deeds and covenants, restrictive covenants. And this model has segregated Kansas City and was used, it was, you know, the model was used around the United States in many, many cities from Baltimore to Washington, D.C. So in Kansas City, we have this memorial fountain celebrating and highlighting the shopping center that he created, right, the plaza. People are really reluctant to rename it. And the argument comes down to rewriting history or sweeping it all under the rug. But I teach this conversation. We learn the history in my class every semester. And then a local journalist reignited the conversation about renaming the memorial fountain. And I have been shocked at how few people know who he is before the conversation. And once they find out that he was an overtly white supremacist person, they continue to say that we should keep the fountain as it is. I think we have a tendency to identify with the person who's made, you know, the quote unquote mistake. I think a lot of white folks do. And because we identify with J.C. Nichols or the Confederate flag, we don't want to tackle it. It requires a lot of, I think, interrogation of self and culture and values, and it's just easier to keep it up. I am a fan of multiple tools in our toolbox, right? We need people who are going to be doing obedience. We need people who are going to be raising funds to get those folks out of jail. We need people who are going to create policy. We need people who are going to have uncomfortable conversations in the bar, right? We need all kinds of tools. And I think we need a lot of different strategies. So this is the other aspect. When I send the email through social media, it's a person of color on the other end. So I think about the ways that that person might have made themselves vulnerable in the workplace, sharing a white lady's concerns about a Confederate flag. That was a risk, right? Taking that, my letter, and sharing it with white coworkers and saying, you know, this woman is concerned, that's risk. That's an actual risk to their job, to the environment that they're working in, you know, possibly subject to microaggressions or people who would belittle it. But let me tell you what, he knew the flag I was talking about. He knew the truck. He knew it was a, you know, a GMC. So my concerns were founded. I mean, it had already impacted people at the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
But that was risk. He took risk. I didn't. The third thing I did, right, two notes, and then the sign in the roadway with the Confederate quotes on it. I'm not sure how effective that was. You know, I thought a lot about it, and I wouldn't have done that again. I wouldn't go that route again. I'm always trying to ask questions about what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and what effect it has and, you know, what my intent and motivation are. But beyond that, what's the impact, right? Because I can be more aware of or control my intention more than I can my impact. So I'm trying to keep that in mind all the time. But I'm going to make mistakes. I mean, a large part of it is readjusting my strategy based on where I've erred.
You know, I was saying earlier, I don't know if I would have done it because, you know, as kind of vocal as I am about, you know, so many issues, I have this fear of interpersonal conflict. I have this aversion to, you know, I'm an avoider of interpersonal conflict. And, you know, being willing to go into the channels like that is really where the rubber meets the road. Also, you know, being willing to say, maybe I didn't do it perfectly. Above all, you know, you're an educator and you spend a lot of time talking to your students about these issues. Are you going to, or have you talked to your students about it?
I did use it as an example of ways that we can take action. I've always, you know, not suggesting that it's effective, because my strategy is not always effective. I'm more confrontational. I'm less diplomatic. I am most of the time willing to make people uncomfortable by saying things. I talk first, I think later. And it's definitely not the communication style of a lot of other people. And I want to be clear that I don't think that my strategy is the best. I've said a lot of things in a lot of places that I wish I would have said differently. But I do think there's something to be said for being courageous and making yourself vulnerable.
You're trolling for justice. That's the important thing.
So my experience with confrontation has been very spotty, because there are some times where I want to assert my voice and I do so, and I kind of follow the same line as you, Rhiannon, where I talk and I say exactly what's on my mind, and then I think about it later and I'm like, oh, I could have probably put that better. Would have probably been less confrontational or been less aggressive in the conveyance of what I believe very wholeheartedly to be truth. And I know that my truth isn't always right either, because we're all learning and we're all trying to do some unlearning of some really harmful norms and schemas and heuristics that have been implanted in us and socialized to the point where we don't know that they're not normal. I want to get better at recognizing those moments of conflict and trying to act in ways that are productive. And trying to find what productive means for me or what it means for the situation. Because like you said, Rhiannon, like we should have lots of different tools. And I think the more people are able to work with multiple tools, the better off we're going to be, because we'll be more adaptable to this fight.
Yeah.
I want to respond to that. Thank you for sharing that experience, both of you. So I also get that sort of biophysical response where I'm nervous and sweaty and adrenaline and full of rage, and my ability to respond in any kind of cogent way goes out the window. But it happens most often with white progressives, right? Like us, mm-hmm. right? In this conversation, I feel like a lot of the times when I'm taking risks, it's with other white people who don't identify, you know, their own lack of risk taking, or, mm-hmm. you know, our own privilege. So I think that on the one hand, so I'm teaching this essay tomorrow called White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Mm-hmm. And she's a white woman. She's a diversity trainer. Yeah. You may be familiar with that.
Yeah.
If you haven't,
I've watched a few videos of hers.
Yeah. She's really great. And one of the things that she talks about with this white fragility is that we have a very low threshold for being uncomfortable racially. And I think a lot of people, we've been taught not to talk about it, right? We don't talk about politics. It's like some social taboo. There's this etiquette around it where we've been really taught to be complacent, to be quiet, to allow people to express their bigotry openly. And having those conversations are somehow inherently, you know, it's problematic. We're the problem. And I've always been the problem in these situations, you know, like if I call things out. And my methods are not always good. Sometimes they, you know, really are problematic. But other times, it's not about doing it perfectly. It's about, you know, taking the risk. And I've sat through things and not said anything. And it's part of the reason why I say things now is because of how uncomfortable my silence made me. I think there's a lot of danger in it. I mean, here we are, where a lot of people are kind of stunned by the world that we're living in. I think it's in part because people have been so reluctant, or we have low racial literacy, or you know, we're uncomfortable making noise. And I think, you know, we only get better at it by practice.
But you also did something that was structural, right? Like going to find out the legal ramifications of a Confederate flag or hate symbols being shown in the workplace. And you were able to enact change there by figuring out how to work within the system.
And you did research, which, I mean...
Yeah.
You know, I think that a lot of people might have a gut reaction to want to do something or try to do something, and it's good when people do what they can do, but you also did like some extra work. And you're right, you know, in saying that, you know, it probably wasn't tremendously difficult research. I mean, that is absolutely going the extra mile in terms of, you know, because you wanted to engage at that structural level of the workplace, saying, well, I should come with something more than just being pissed off.
Anybody can do it, and you can do it comfortably because it's writing a letter. You can do it from home. You know, you don't have to have a lot of resources.
Thank you so much, Rhiannon, for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, this has been a great conversation too. And thanks for sort of helping us talk about our own experiences too.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. And Scully, I'm going to friend you on Facebook if that's cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I can give up that room, but I would like that room to be a guest room, or I would like us to always have a guest room.
Mm-hmm.
That is an important component of mm-hmm. what we're doing.
We're moving out of the kids' room, so that could be...
That could mm-hmm. also be the guest room. Yeah,
right.
That's
because
easy.
All the kids will be there all
yeah.
the time.
And we could even put multiple beds in that room.
Right. Are you recording?
Maybe.
Uh-huh.
What's up?
I wanted to wake up earlier than I did to get another round of closet painting done.
Yeah.
But I didn't.
That I'm going to wake up early and do something almost never works for me.
No.
And I always think it's going to.
I was thinking back to memories that I had of the first times that I saw you speak. The speeches at Carleton and at Friends University in Wichita, in which you began with an apology.
Yeah, I tend to do that when I'm speaking to college students or younger, because I think our generation has done a really crappy job mm-hmm. of owning our contributions to the problems.
So. What's the apology? How does it, I mean, what's the basic content of the apology? You don't have to give it verbatim, but,
yeah.
But what does it contain?
I mean, the gist of it is recognizing that I feel like young people have gotten a lot of messages from my generation and my parents' generation about how they're screwing things up. And there's very little on our parts of admitting that we actually set a lot of stuff up for the younger generations in terms of, you know, climate disruption, in terms of the economy, and that I want them to hear at least once from someone who's 50-ish or older that we handed them a really terrible set of situations, and that I want to be really humble about that and work on doing what I can in cooperation with them and as much as possible following their leadership as we're moving forward.
Right. So what, I mean, what do you basically say? What's the basic like content of the apology? Do you remember even?
Oh gosh. I mean, it's basically, I'm really, really sorry that we have left you this mess to clean up, and I will do everything that I can to partner with you on cleaning it up before I die. Mm-hmm. That's the gist of it.
Right, right. Yeah. What's the most interesting, I guess, reaction that you've gotten from somebody about that?
Yeah, I have had a couple of people come up to me afterward, and, you know, I remember one young woman in particular, like, literally came up to me with tears in her eyes and said, I have never heard anyone from your generation or older say anything like that, and it's what everybody my age knows, and you know, and so for her it hit a really tender place, you know, when you've been wronged in some way and you've been waiting for years to hear the person say it, and I think that's what a really good apology can do, is it opens us up to being in connection with each other in a deeper way, in a more real way. And I think young people know what they've been handed for the most part.
Where did you pick that up? Or, you know, was it something that you picked up from another speaker or an idea? When did you first think to do it?
I mean, I don't know that I really picked it up from someone else. I mean, I think I feel really connected to the work that that Joanna Macy does, the work that reconnects, which is really about getting into your emotional body with these big crises that are happening. And you know, and a number of other people that talk about the idea that we're kind of in collective hospice right now, that there's a way that we could like really be owning what's happening on the planet. And, you know, and that's really emotional territory. And for me, there's an authenticity that's really important about doing ecological activism work right now. And apologies are just what you do when you recognize that you fucked up. And so I don't know that I really got it from any one source in particular. It's more that it just has felt consistently like I can't stand up in front of an audience and talk about what the state of the world is and how to fix it without first acknowledging the state of things right now. And to me, that it's seems fairly obvious that apologies are in order, and not just like oh yeah, I'm really sorry, but like I'm really fucking sorry about where we've left things, and then following that up with action so that it's not just words, but it's actually like, let's now try to structure the world a little bit differently so that things are different moving forward.
Consciousness shifts are important, but policies and laws are obviously really critical, because I mean, that's basically what a policy or a law is an encoded sort of agreement of collective action. Now, I know that in the system that we have now, that's not how policy and law work. Policies and laws are, you know, created to maintain, you know, existing power structures, and you know, pretty much buy your way into the position where you can influence that, you know, those policies and laws. But in a world where that's not the case, and you have been entrusted, you know, you and others, you know, have been entrusted to make those types of decisions or to recommend changes in policies and laws. Where would you start if you had, you know, if you had influence over, you know, for example, in our system, both the legislative and executive, you know, branches of government? What specific things now Mm-hmm. What do we need to do?
Yeah, I get a little bit flummoxed when I try to separate out the policy stuff from the other stuff, because I think that we got here through a really deeply interrelated set of things that are like economic, and they're cultural, and they're legal and mm-hmm. political,
sure.
and that they're all sort of, you know, jumbled up together. And if I could sort of cut through all of that stuff and get to like one or two like policy things that I would love to see happen like yesterday, I think the combination that I would go for is like, let's just stop subsidizing fossil fuels. It's like $4.6 billion a year by some estimates that the fossil fuel companies get from our government agencies mm-hmm. and put that money into green technology and tree planting. You know how many trees you could plant with $4.6 billion? Like, it's huge. And that's one of the biggest recommendations that's coming out of a lot of the international mm-hmm. bodies that are talking about solutions to climate change is like, you know, massive reforestation efforts around the mm-hmm. globe. And because it's not just about reducing our carbon emissions, it's also mm-hmm. about, you know, carbon sequestration
right.
and, you know, all that kind right. of stuff. And so that combination, and you couldn't actually do that and have it be a humane policy without doing something else that actually stops it from ending up screwing over poor people. Because
mm-hmm.
if
mm-hmm.
you stop the subsidies, then like the people that are going to end up mm-hmm. paying for it. And so, you know, one of the organizations that is actually a really mainstream organization in a lot of ways, but that I think has a really good policy agenda is the Citizens Climate Lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you moved the subsidies from fossil fuels over to green technology and reforestation efforts, and at the same time implemented the carbon fee and dividend plan that CCL is talking about, where basically there'd be a tax slapped on carbon every time it comes out of the ground, and then that money would get evenly redistributed across society among everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea behind that is that as prices go up at the pump or as people's heating bills go up, that they would then have money to mm-hmm. be able to cover that. And so you wouldn't end up with like more
provided
people freezing on the
street. Distribution of that money actually
happens.
Right.
The way right. That, well, this is your magic wand question. My main focus of my work is on cooperative culture developments and intentional community development. And there are laws all over the country that make it incredibly difficult to get intentional communities off the ground. That, you know, there's laws saying, you know, you can only have so many unrelated adults living under one roof together. And it's like, you know, and those policies were not intended to block intentional communities originally. They were actually racist policies that were, you know, put in place trying to stop immigrant families from like bringing their cousins over and having them all be in a big house together and that kind of stuff. So the roots come from a different place that I also find deeply offensive. But at this point, those laws are making it really difficult for a lot of people, particularly in urban environments, to organize intentional communities. And so there's a whole batch of stuff that I think could get reformed that would make it much easier to do truly grassroots organizing and, you know, really putting in place communities that, you know, would also be, you know, helping us reduce our carbon footprints pretty significantly if we were able to organize them more easily.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of policy things that I care about.
So the reason that you would like to see it be very easy to create cooperative communities, intentional communities, you have seen, and there is research that confirms that, you know, we can cut our energy use by 90%,
mm-hmm.
Which is way above and beyond any of the targets that
right.
nations and international bodies are talking about.
Right.
Right. And that we can do that with intentional communities. To highlight that this decrease in use is not really, you know, doesn't feel, at least to me, having, you know, experienced some of it, it has not felt to me to be very austere. It hasn't been, you know, to me, like, you know, I did not see it as, you know, as living a, I don't know, a monastic or ascetic life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. like I didn't, you know, like I had internet, the food was good.
It didn't seem like I could wash my clothes.
It wasn't deprivation.
It wasn't deprivation. It was fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were things about it that were different, but I got all my needs met and most of my even wants met.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even really describe what the difference was, except the process of doing things was a little bit different. But
mm-hmm.
So all of this is possible. And that's really what your book is about,
mm-hmm. Right.
That, you know, so there are models, there are physical, material models I want to get right to the kind of skeptical question, or the question that skeptical people would ask about this, particularly a lot of people on the left who are highly suspicious or distrustful of communes, of lifestyle changes, of, you know, hippie shit.
right.
And, you know, what you're saying in their terms is, no, you could materially scale this. And I guess, so that's the skeptic's question, mm-hmm. is, can you scale that? You know, I mean,
yeah, sure.
It's fine. So you're doing it for 68 people in Rutledge, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it for, you know, for mm-hmm. several hundred times that amount, several thousand times that
right.
amount
right.
of humans without, and don't say, well, you know, humans shouldn't have settled in cities Arizona or, you know, whatever, like, because they're there. So, you know, and you're not, and you don't want to coerce people. So what?
Right,
you know.
Right. Well, so the main example that you're talking about, and the one that you and I have both spent the most time in, is at Dancing Rabbit Eco Village in Rutledge, Missouri, which is running at about 10% of the U.S. average of consumption. And so that's the 68-person version that mm-hmm. you're talking about. And
so 10%
of the U.S.
what?
Average of consumption of...
Consumption of what?
Of resources. So fossil fuels, water, electricity. Mm-hmm. I mean, all their electricity, not all of it, but most of their electricity is produced off-grid. So, you know, even with that, they're still really reducing their electricity consumption. And that's that good life that you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
that you can get out of that with at that 10% level. And so, you know, when people talk about, is it scalable? You know, one of the best examples in the US of people living with really low carbon footprints is Manhattan. And a lot of it is that there's public transit. It's very walkable. Living spaces tend to be small. Like, there's all these jokes about the postage stamp apartments in Manhattan. And mm-hmm. that's true. You know, there are, you know, smaller living spaces. And that's actually one of the things that really makes a big difference. So, you know, I say toward the end of the book that, you know, that basically if we're going to end up with a society that works from a carbon emission standpoint, it's going to look like either Dancing Rabbit or Twin Oaks Community, which is another one that I profile in the book, or Manhattan, and that mm-hmm. those are both viable options for how we go about doing this. And I don't actually know what the exact statistics are on Manhattan, but it's a fraction mm-hmm. of your average American's consumption. So yes, this is absolutely scalable. I also talk about the country of Bhutan, which is the only place in the world, the only country in the world that has a negative carbon footprint at this point, and that's an entire nation, and mm-hmm. it's a small one, but it's got more people than the state of Wyoming does, so mm-hmm. I think that these are definitely scalable options, and it's that combination of reducing our emissions and planting a lot of trees that is what makes Bhutan a viable option. So you can either be super compact in a city, or you can be, you know, heavily into cooperation like at Dancing Rabbit in Twin Oaks, or you can be engaging the combination of a less materialistic culture and a heck of a lot of forest. Mm-hmm. And that's the Bhutan model. And any of those work.
Uh-huh.
If we're going to solve things like climate disruption, we have got to be thinking clearly. We've got to be able to do that work. And right now, you know, as more and more information is coming out, like the scientific community keeps coming out with worse and worse news. Like, the news isn't just suddenly getting better about climate change. It's getting, you know, we're getting news that, like, it's worse than we thought it was going to be. It's happening faster than we thought it was happening. The impacts are less predictable than we thought we were. We're sort of descending into a really bad space right now. And if you put your attention on it for more than 3 seconds at a time, you probably are going to feel something. and it's probably going to be distress related. And so we got to be able to work through that stuff, you know, and I don't think it happens by stuffing it. I think that just causes us to not think.
No, I know that's true,
like,
about
super fucking
things
unhelpful.
In my life. I know that's totally, true about things totally. In my life that are much smaller. You know, than climate change, things that I can actually do something about.
Right.
If it's a problem in my life, like a financial issue or whatever, I can't think clearly when I'm panicking about it.
Right.
So if
there's deep parallels between like what people are experiencing around climate change and what people are experiencing around economic collapse right now. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like really big and it's really kind of slow-mo. And every once in a while, something happens that brings it to the forefront of our brains, whether that's in our personal lives, like we bounce a check and a cascade of things happens.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is about capitalism, you know, but this is like the way that it's showing up personally. And so, you know, my basic theory is we have got to be doing our personal work and have got to be in our emotional bodies if we want to actually do good problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's true whether you're like organizing a political campaign or you're trying to change policies or you're trying to organize an intentional community. Like, I don't care what it is, you've got to be able to think clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me is like the primary piece around that part of the, you know, the one that I have the best scientific backing for. I also think there's this thing about decolonizing our consciousness from consumerism. And, you know, that we are taught that consumerism is kind of the end all be all, you know, what's the phrase? It's not recreational shopping, shopping therapy, you know, like this is like kind of like it's a very American joke is like this is what's going to help you get through your distress is to go shopping. It's like we need to like root that shit out of our consciousness if we're actually going to be, you know, embodying a lifestyle that is at more of that 10% mark. With stuff. So there's a whole package of like personal stuff. And then there's the interpersonal stuff. Mm-hmm. And basically, we have got to be able to cooperate if we're going to build the world that we want to build, whether that's, you know, a socialist economy, you know, the new economy, you know, all the work that's happening in the New Economy Coalition, that's all deeply based on moving toward cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Your book, Together Resilient, Building Community in the Age of Climate Disruption, was named the 2017 Book of the Year by the Communal Studies Association. It is, you know, it really describes this notion of really materializing these solutions, and especially materializing ground up kind of grassroots, in some ways local solutions. Although I don't think you're saying that there shouldn't also be national and international solutions.
Definitely not. I just am not qualified to write a book about that. So, you know, you write about what you're qualified to write about, I hope. So my focus is on locally self-determined solutions in the book.
Mm-hmm. Which obviously, you know, would have to be scaled and would have to be reproduced and done in very different ways, in many, many different spaces for it to make a difference. It seems like it's implicit in why you would write a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, let's have a lot of people do this.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to tell people to buy the book, it's Together Resilient, and I also wanted to read a passage from it, and this is the Everyone's Work chapter, Cultural and Emotional Integration chapter.
What'd they say?
In Collapsing Consciously, which is the name of the book, Carolyn Baker says, we must prepare for a very uncertain future by consciously cultivating emotional resilience. I've been through my own journey around that in the past 5 years as climate change has slowly become more real for me. Here's one story from my own life. This is a story from your life that you're writing. It is April 2015, and I'm at a B&B in Greensboro, North Carolina, on one of the rare days off during a national speaking tour. I've been talking nonstop about community and climate change for 6 weeks, and the emotional intensity has caught up with me. I'm a wreck, and in my isolation, I'm dealing with it with alcohol. I've been pushing the message that one of the most critical things we need to do right now is the emotional work around planetary devastation. When we put our attention to climate change and leave it there long enough to notice what is present for us emotionally, most of us come right up against a soul-numbing blend of anger, fear, grief, and if we are from one of the countries that has contributed a lot to the crisis, guilt and shame. On the tour, I've placed myself squarely on the front lines of that emotional crisis. At home, surrounded by my eco-village friends, the emotional content is easier to handle. I have people around me who don't think I'm nuts for feeling deeply the grieving of the losses, the loss of the forest and oceans, the potential loss of my children's full and healthy lives, the loss of direct communion with the natural world. I have people around me who feel the anger, the fear, the guilt, but are doing something with it other than putting their heads in the sand. I have people around me who have committed their lives to doing something about it. At the B&B, I'm surrounded by human beauty, antiques, a lovely old farmhouse, gracious hosts, and it is illusory, the best expressions of a world built on the unreality of an economic and value system that is destroying us. I am profoundly isolated in this place, in spite of being in a city of nearly 300,000 fellow humans. I am caught and sinking fast, deeply connected to the emotions and alone in dealing with them.
It was a rough night. I remember that night really clearly, yeah. So I find myself, mostly as I'm listening to that, grateful to have landed once again in a community where I feel like I can be real about stuff, and very grateful to have a group of companions again. You know, I stepped out of Dancing Rabbit 2 years ago and got to spend a couple years in, you know, doing the nuclear family thing and, you know, having that kind of isolation. And I'm grateful to not be having to do that anymore.
Well, our friend Archer went to the archives and found a bunch of stuff, and we're
which is how
still...
we got the phrenology report.
Right, which is right, where we got the phrenology, right. The very important phrenology
but I,
report.
What I want to know about the archives is there anything about it being haunted in the archives? And I don't think we've found anything yet, because we've heard from multiple people that it's haunted.
Including...
And some of it is just like, it just looks like it should be haunted, frankly. And it's old enough that, like, if haunting is a real thing, this place surely has had, like, spirits cling to it at some point or another.
Well, especially if the story of it being a brothel at some point is true, then the likelihood of there being energy here that meets the qualification for supernatural, I think that would be
interesting. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. If this place is haunted, we become a completely different podcast.
It's going to get painted.
Painting is
going
to happen.
We're in the process of getting the lead exterior paint covered, stripped all of the parts that are... So we're getting professional people out to come do this the right way, and then getting a new coat of paint that will hopefully be less... depressingly
parts of the house
neglected.
What parts of the house are going to be painted in this big, huge, gigantic paint job? This particular
one is just the outside. It's the whole outside of the big house.
And describe some of the challenging or kind of important parts of that.
I'm really curious how the hell they're going to get up there, because there's this spire that goes up above. So we have what did we figure out? It was actually octagonal minus with two of those kind of...
It's seven sides, but one of the sides is twice
like a double side. Yeah, so it's an octagonal shape. There's a room on the main floor and then a room above it that are octagonal shaped. And then above that, in what would be the third story...
Is our logo.
Yeah. Right. It's the Widow's Walk you know, what I think it's really called. And then there's a spire that goes up from the Widow's Walk, another like... 12 feet or something in the air. Maybe not quite that much, but it's
and
way
gables,
up there.
And there's gables
there's
all
gables.
Around it. We have more gables than the House of Seven Gables.
Yes, we have many gables. The House of many, many,
that
many
is at
gables.
Least eight
we
gables.
Are the Solidarity House of at least eight gables.
I love a lot of things about this. I love all the wood. Like, there's just so much beautiful woodwork, some of which is painted over, and I'd love to restore it. And all the wood floors make me really happy. And so we'll have to play a game. If you come and visit us, we're not going to tell you where it is, but there's this game that I want to start, which is find the Patron cork.
Because somewhere in our house, an old element was replaced with a Patron cork. And so if you can come here
You've taken my favorite Patron cork.
Oh, no.
It's a favorite of multiples of us. Yeah, but I want to turn it into a game. I come visit and find
the Patron cork. And I'm glad you said that, though, because I wasn't going to immediately say
it. Say where it was, yeah. I love the wallpaper in the dining room. We have this ongoing little aesthetic battle about, like, which we have four kinds of wallpaper in the house, and everybody's got their favorite, and they're all sort of terrible in their own ways, but I really like the one in the dining room. It's like, it's bumpy, and it's got texture to it.
I think the wallpaper in the main hallway is the closest to what I would imagine like a Victorian style wallpaper would be, because it has like the fleur-de-lis shape and that. Or kind of paisley-ish.
So we have cow pasture on both sides of us on either side. But when the cows are not in that pasture, the antelopes sort of take it over. And there's been this family, or gathering anyway, that has a bunch of small ones with it. And I've never been around antelope because I'm not from the West, so I still find them charming, even though I've been assured they're incredibly stupid and annoying.
I have lots of favorites, but I'm also just thinking about what it will be versus what it is at the moment. So trying to take appreciation for what is there. I like the stairs quite a lot because I painted them.
we have pictures. We have proof.
I like my space. It's not part of the house proper. It's the most recent addition, the high efficiency apartment thing that was, I believe, built on premise.
I think
right?
so. I think it was built in between. So there's four motel rooms that got turned into two apartments, and then in between those two apartments, there's the efficiency apartment.
They're really nice.
Yeah, mine is, I think of it as a Upper Peninsula hunting cabin aesthetic. It's like all this like wood paneling and stuff. And I, of course, grew up there, so it makes me super happy.
And then the room we're in right now is the 50s style apartments. It's the motel rooms, or hotel rooms? Motel rooms?
I think motel rooms, because they've got the doors going out.
Yeah, feels kind of motel-y.
Yeah.
And it's definitely got a 50s vibe.
You know, we all have, you know, some of us have, you know, many, many different, you know, gig jobs, and others of us have, you know, have to show up for work jobs. And so oftentimes we're just exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're coming back to this and kind of going, you know, there's so much to do and we have to keep making money so that we can, you know, pay
to try
the loan and continue to make improvements. And
it already feels like a sanctuary to me. I mean, I come home at night and I'm like, oh, this is cool.
I'm hoping I will get that feeling more when I move into my space, because right now I feel kind of like
displaced.
Yeah.
We're taking on a big project here and we need your help.
We are restoring this beautiful, huge house built in 1878 and the 3 acres of land it's on.
We're doing it so that it can be a cooperative, communal space for people to live, work, create, and do activism.
We want to share income and resources and be a place where people can live and thrive no matter how much money they make.
There are many ways that you can help us, but the most mutually beneficial way is to subscribe to Solidarity House on Patreon.
Your subscription supports the effort to restore the house and the land, and it gets you access to tons of bonus material, including full unedited interviews, our original music, and more.
Please subscribe to Solidarity House and help us grow a commune out here.
And remember, you're getting 3 podcasts for the price of 1. Solidarity House, Solidarity Wyoming, and Cowboys on the Commons.
Yeehaw! We're Solidarity House on Patreon and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.
The community is a very contestable concept, and it should be treated as such, right? There's not one group or one ideology that really has a claim to it. And so as a consequence, you or we can reclaim this, and we can endlessly argue with people about what is the correct way to do it all.
That sounds so much fun. Like, almost like an argument between Trotskyists and tankies.
Absolutely. And it will end the same way.
Well, there's plenty to buy, but no money to buy it. Lots of jobs that don't support us while the rich have empty land. So we work the day away on that gig economy diet, masturbating with the invisible hand.
Here.
We wanna break, break, break
our chains.
Break, break, break
our chains.
Break our chains and go build something new. We wanna break, break, break so we can make, make, make a world for the many, not the few. Now some people say go vote, don't get me wrong. We all should vote, but more would vote if they like what they're voting for. And it's hard to organize when money has got you by the throat, and all our choices seem to be things we abhor. We wanna break, break, break
our chains.
Break, break, break
our chains.
Break our chains and go build something just. We wanna break, break, break so we can make, make, make a world of security. And trust. Go Scully. Well, you can walk their dogs, or you can chop their logs, or you can clean up after their soiree. Just be sure to keep in mind that we can leave it all behind in solidarity. Find a better way.
Hey.
We wanna break, break, break
our chains.
Break, break, break
our chains.
Break our chains and go build something fair. We wanna break, break, break so we can make, make, make a world you would like if you're a billionaire.
Hey.
We wanna break, break, break
our chains.
Break, break, break
our chains.
Break our chains and go build something new.
Hi, you've reached Solidarity House, but we can't take your call. If you have a message for Yana, Scully, Gibran, Matt, or anybody else, please leave it now.